Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internets. This is episode 231 of Registry Matters. Happy Saturday. Good evening to you, sir. How are you?
Awesome. Thank you. Internets. Are there more than one internet now?
I think probably that technically would be true because the government has their like private SIPA net, I think SIPA, C-I-P-A, something like that. There's a secure internet. I don't know that that runs over the normal internet. There might be its own set of wires and tubes.
So, okay.
Sipper? God, I can't remember what that one was called. Anyway, a friend of mine has to go into a special room without his phone or anything else to use certain secured communication stuff for him to do his work. He's in the Air Force. Do you want to banter anything? How about we banter about the EPA case and how it may or may not relate to Gundy? We'll take 5 minutes before we go dive into everything with this little bit of information that came out a couple days ago.
Sure.
So I saw a post from someone that said this came on the Narsal social media site, and he said, "So I heard this morning that the EPA cannot make up their own rules with how to interpret the laws. That is for Congress to clarify. I'm sure, and of course it's been said by commentary on the news and other federal agencies have to do the same thing. Therefore, it should clamp down on other government agencies making up rules as to how to interpret laws passed by Congress. So here's the question. What can we and the agencies that fight for registrants bring about in challenges against the Adam Walsh Act and International Megan's Law? What guidance, rules, and instructions have been made to interpret these laws by agencies that we feel should be interpreted by Congress? Sorry, my mind is always running and turning on avenues to fighting these things. Would love to hear what everyone else thinks." So, what would be the intersection between Gundy, that was 2019, Maryland, Pennsylvania, New York, as I was reading. What does that have to do with the administrative state compare that against the EPA?
But how does it intersect? In my opinion, not very well, because the Congress actually did make the Adam Walsh Act. They did pass it. What's at issue with the EPA is that they are actually creating the law. They are taking an administration who wants to go clean energy, who cannot pass that agenda through the legislative process, and they're imposing their desire to see us move to clean energy more rapidly, and they're doing that by imposing regulations. That is not even close to what the Adam Walsh Act was about. The Adam Walsh Act was passed by Congress. Every single aspect of it was passed. I mean, if you look in the Dropbox folder, there's one called Adam Walsh Act as passed by Congress.
I have seen it.
Yes, it's sitting there right now.
Yep.
So Congress did pass the Adam Walsh Act. The only thing that was delegated was trying to figure out how to constitutionally carry out the will of the people as decided by Congress in this 64-page act that was signed in 2006. And there had already been significant litigation against registration when they started registering people other than California, had been doing it since 1947, and I think Washington State since 1990. But when they passed the Wetterling Act in 1994, there had been a good decade of states having registration schemes, and there had been significant litigation, people rebelling against these registration schemes, saying they were unconstitutional. So Congress recognized that there may be constitutional issues in terms of how broadly they can do this in certain states because of adverse court decisions that had already been issued and handed down. So the Congress said, yes, we do recognize that you may have some issues. And they thought about who they would refer that to try to figure it out. And they thought about very carefully, and it seemed like the Department of Justice, with all the vast amount of legal talent they have, would be best suited to figure out how to constitutionally apply and enforce the will of the people. That is not the same thing as what these regulatory agencies like the EPA and OSHA are doing, the Congress doesn't tell you specifically what OSHA should do to eliminate particular work hazards in the workplace, because the workplace is constantly evolving. The technology that we were running in the cotton mills in 1910, that technology would probably not be causing many work hazards today, because I don't know how many mill operations are similar to what was happening in 1910. I mean, do you? I'm not an expert in this, but what would you say the similarity to the workplace of 1910 would be to 2022?
I would go for pretty much zero.
So therefore, as the occupations have evolved, Congress can't constantly update what to do about ridding the workplace of unreasonable hazards. So therefore, they have told Congress, Congress has told the particular department to figure it out and keep workers safe. That is not what they did in the Adam Walsh Act. They passed every provision that's in the Adam Walsh Act.
If Congress had said, I'm just going to throw out some numbers. If they said 40 parts per million, you know, whatever, like, would they then be able to go, hey, you have to go fix your shit because we're exceeding 40 parts per million, whatever, like, however that would actually go about. If Congress had done that, would it be okay then? So if Congress had written into it something to the effect of like 40 parts per million for these particulates, whatever, like, however that would go down, would that be the equivalent to then saying people convicted of sexual offenses?
Yes, if Congress had actually specified, but, and I haven't read this case, like I say, it's too long, and I haven't read it yet, so I don't know exactly what the issues were, but I know that in general, what the conservatives oppose about the administrative state is that Congress has not defined these things. They've left it to the agency. In the case of the Adam Walsh Act, Congress defined every bit of it.
But, God, I'm just so, like, where you just went saying OSHA, it sounds like then people could file claims saying OSHA violates, I don't know, my constitutional right to have an unsafe work environment. Therefore, I want to not wear masks and hearing protection and so forth.
Well, I guess I'm not following and tracking with that question. OSHA tries to keep the workplace safer. It's sure. It's not about your rights as the worker. The OSHA, the requirements are imposed on the employer. The employer tells you that you will wear this equipment. The employer is told what type of equipment they can have and whether it has to have a protective cover or whatever, and how fastly they can run, how rapidly they can run this equipment. I mean, all this stuff is geared toward the employer. There's very little OSHA that tells the employee what to do.
Sure. All right. I'll come up with better questions to ask you. But people, anyway, the whole point is that people think that if we with the EPA case saying that the administrative state, these executive agencies, they are not allowed to go do these things, that is unconstitutional, that then that would also then apply to the Department of Justice and AWA should then collapse.
I don't see it that way. I hear people saying that, but I don't see it that way because it's not the same comparison. If you didn't ask the Department of Justice, if Congress would be remiss if they knew that there were constitutional problems in some of the states with retroactively imposing registration obligations on populations, would you have been happier if Congress would have said, to hell with that, we'll just go ahead and pass it anyway? So they did pass it, but they said, look, Attorney General, you have expertise we don't have. You decide. If there are states and jurisdictions that this can't apply in, that's your job. And in fact, there's a provision in the Adam Walsh Act that says if a state cannot implement parts of it because of a ruling from the highest court in the state, they don't lose their precious burn grants. That's in the law itself, as written by Congress. So asking an agency that is in the administration of justice business to try to figure out if something can be done across the nation seems like a fairly rational approach to me.
How about this? One final point, one thing to finally ask. Can you give like a one-liner? What would you tell someone to then go look up in their, ask themselves a question in making these comparisons? So I guess an example would be when you look at the AWA, it says people convicted of a sexual offense. That's a binary. That's a yes or a no. You either is or you isn't convicted of. And by comparison, there's nothing that says the EPA should regulate this thing specifically other than to go, hey, go make the air cleaner and keep the water safe.
Well, I'm saying that generally without having read the decision. My understanding of what the EPA's mission is, as it was created in 1970 under the conservative Nixon administration, with his acquiescence, for those who don't remember how the EPA came into existence, it was under Democrat Congress with a Republican president who had very conservative credentials and was accepted as being pro-business. That agency was created back in 1970, I believe. But I believe its overall mission is very generalized. Therefore, it does have rulemaking authority because the need of the environment, I wouldn't say the need is changing, the need is to have a cleaner, safer environment. But as we evolve in technology that we can, power plants running in 1970 were a lot different in terms of their pollution scrubbing and their technology that they were running in 1970 compared to today. So if you left the standards of the equipment that they were operating in 1970 in place, the air would be much dirtier than it is today.
I gotcha. So
therefore, Congress, as I've explained in disability determination process, Congress would never be able to be sufficiently informed about all the different technological changes that would allow them to adjust those requirements as technology evolves. I'm not an expert in pollution control by any means, but technology, I listened to enough legislative committee hearings to understand that the technology at our four corners, we got two power plants at four corners, New Mexico. We've got San Juan Generating Station, and I forget the name of the other one, but there's two power plants. And the technology has evolved dramatically since 1970, but San Juan is still dirty compared to what they would like for it to be, and they've decided that they're just going to close the plant. You know, those facilities are going to be taken offline because they can't meet those standards, as I understand it. But Congress would never be able to do that.
Sure.
But
sure,
on
sure.
The other hand, Congress clearly defined what constitutes a sexual offender.
Right.
And they clearly defined the two tiers and the duration of the two tiers and how quickly a person should have to register upon conviction and upon changes of the address. And all this stuff is in the Adam Walsh Act. That wasn't delegated. The only thing that was delegated was trying to figure out how to do it constitutionally because you're going to have problems in some states. And if it wasn't the Department of Justice, who would you have referred it to? The Department of Defense?
Yes, I understand.
I can't think of a better agency to ask for help to figure out how to do something than the Department of Justice. That's supposedly the business they're in.
I don't want to drag this out. The only thing, though, is EPA would be the scientist and things that are related to environment. And I'm not saying that for your benefit. I'm saying that for everybody else. Like, the EPA is, that's the environment people, right? OSHA would be for occupational safety.
So that's the way I understand it.
I hear you. All right. We'll move along then because. So we're just going to dive right into the May case. You think that this is going to cover the whole, this and the other, the Seventh Circuit's going to cover the rest of the night?
Well, it depends on how much you take from the audience and how much you come up with on your own volition.
All right. So people in chat, I need help. I need questions from you to make sure that this goes along and is fully covered. And so I didn't ask you what's going on tonight, but I think this will cover it. So there are two cases that you wanted to discuss this evening. The first case is of Stephen May from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the case is May versus Shin, and that's Shin with two N's. The second is a recent decision from the Seventh Circuit of Appeals dealing with GPS monitoring for PFRs. The name of that case is Benjamin Brom and others versus Kevin Carr, and that's Carr with two R's, Wisconsin Secretary of Corrections. Let's do the May case first because it will probably take less time. Let me set this up if I can. The case has been going on for years and years. May initially won in federal habeas court a declaration that Arizona's CM was unconstitutional. And of course, the state appealed to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit initially affirmed the habeas judge, but it did not last. The state asked for reconsideration. The three-judge panel changed their mind and decided that habeas judge was incorrect in his decision, and especially for releasing Stephen from custody. I do recall that he was out for a period of time, like 6 months or a year or something like that, Larry?
4 years.
Oh, geez. Okay, so I must have met him in between all of that. And then, so now, and he is serving a 75-year sentence. Is that pretty much like the overview, the synopsis of what's going on?
You're doing a fantastic job.
Fantastic. All right. So what in particular do you want to add to this long-running saga now? Didn't Stephen Legal's team, we've talked about this a bunch of times, on like everything possible under the sun has been filed and tried in every angle, and even the Supreme Court has denied cert?
Yes. They recently, in 2022, they filed a motion to recall the mandate of the Ninth Circuit. So that's what they filed.
Okay, so I can, like, recall means to take away, and then the mandate. So what would that be, a recall of a mandate?
Well, the mandate was that they had initially, as you said, they had affirmed the trial judge, the habeas judge, I should say, not the trial judge. And then they, on reconsideration, they reversed themselves. So they issued what's called a mandate to send that case back to the habeas judge and saying, hey, you got it wrong. Pull this guy back into custody. The conviction stands. So that's what the mandate was. So they had filed a motion to recall that mandate of the Court of Appeals.
How often is that granted?
I don't think I've ever heard of one being granted.
All right. And when I was reading it, it appears that they were arguing that there was no jurisdiction because Stephen had been released from custody. And does this mean that it would have been better if Stephen had remained in prison? Like, I can't imagine that there's ever a case where it's better to remain in prison. Should he have refused to leave when the trial judge ordered his immediate release?
Did you read the motion?
I read pieces of it.
I thought you read the whole motion, but yes, it does mean that well, nobody's going to refuse being released from custody, but I don't think it would have really made any difference in the final outcome of this case. But it is interesting. But yeah, we'll dig deeper as you go.
Let's see. So the petitioner, from what I read, the petitioner Stephen May respectfully requests that this court recall its mandate filed on March 30th of 2021 and vacate this court's judgment because the entire proceeding in this court is and was from the beginning void for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. And I'm not an attorney, Larry, but this does seem strange. Were they going... were they arguing that the federal district judge that ruled in May's favor had jurisdiction and suddenly, inexplicably, somehow the Court of Appeals would not have the authority to review the work of the lower federal court?
You've got that correct. That is precisely what they argued.
I first thought I was not reading it right, but from what I was reading. Anyway, the order states May's motion to recall the mandate is denied. Motions that assert a judgment is void because of a jurisdictional defect generally must show that the court that rendered judgment lacked even an arguable basis for jurisdiction. Relying on United States Student Aid Funds Incorporated versus Epinosa, May has not met that standard in arguing that the statutory in custody requirement was unsatisfied. What is in custody requirement? What are they referencing there?
Well, in order for a person to avail themselves of a federal habeas proceeding, they must be in custody. And federal habeas takes a much broader look at what constitutes in custody, and they include probation. But May was no longer on probation, and we can certainly say he was not in custody. I mean, you were seeing him in the flesh, right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so he was not in custody. He was not on any type of probation supervision because his conviction had been voided by the habeas judge, because the habeas judge, Judge Wake, had found that the statute, the child molestation statute in Arizona, was unconstitutional. But they were asserting that May being out of custody rendered the federal court powerless. In essence, they were attempting to exploit the fact that the federal judge had ordered his release and combining that with the fact that the statute had been declared unconstitutional. The argument at least did have some merit, but unfortunately not much, because the Ninth Circuit had reversed the habeas judge's determination that the statute was unconstitutional. Now, that's a whole discussion that I didn't know if we were going to get into tonight, but they had decided that he had been foreclosed on making that constitutional argument because he had not raised it below. So therefore, I disagree with that. But the constitutionality was no longer questioned because the federal habeas judge had been reversed. He said, you didn't have the jurisdiction. You considered an argument that had been foreclosed.
So if we, do you mind if I read something from the judge's extended comments?
Oh, I'd love to hear you read. That means I don't have to think.
I think the point of his commentary is what we sometimes need activist judges. In 1968, I was a young solo practitioner in Suffolk County, New York, when the New York State Court of Appeals assigned me to represent Robert Clayton. It was just a few years after the Supreme Court had held in Jackson versus Denmo that those who had been convicted based on a confession had the right to a hearing to determine if it was voluntary. Clayton had been indicted and convicted for murder as a result of a fight he had with a fellow migrant farm worker. Pursuant to People versus Huntley, the New York equivalent to Jackson, the trial court held a hearing to determine whether his confession was voluntary. I was assigned to handle this appeal. Ultimately, Clayton's conviction was ruled to be the product of a pattern of police dominance and coercion. Clayton had spent about 20 years in jail and gave him the good news. Rather than retry him, the Suffolk County District Attorney had agreed to allow him to plead to involuntary manslaughter with credit for time served. Clayton would be a free man. To my surprise, he rejected the offer. He told me that he had adjusted to a life in prison and wasn't sure he could adjust to a life out of prison as a convicted felon. I didn't know what to do, but the trial court, on its own motion, dismissed the indictment in the interest of justice pursuant to New York Criminal Process Law, subsection 210.40. Is that what he was suggesting should occur in this case?
That, yes, that is precisely what this judge is suggesting should occur. But the government appealed, arguing before the intermediate appellate court that never in the annals of the law had a murder indictment been dismissed on the court's own motion and in the absence of the district attorney's consent in the so-called interest of justice. And in a precedent-making decision, Judge Hopkins, writing for a unanimous court, affirmed the power of the court to dismiss any indictment upon its own initiative in the interest of justice and establish the substantive standards to be henceforth employed in evaluating when principle of justice required dismissal, and asserted that a hearing must be held to determine if the dismissal was warranted. And that was pursuant to Clayton, the case that was referred to, a New York case from many, many years ago. So that's exactly what he's saying, that we might need just a little bit of that judicial activism here.
But that's something that people always rail against, saying, no, we don't want activist judges, you know, like ones that would overturn 50-year-old precedent, right?
Right. But this instance here with May, that's exactly what you need. You need, yes, an activist court that will say, hey, this is wrong. But if you want your textualists that most of our audience say that they're so fond of, well, they're following the text of the law. They're working within the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which we'll get to in a little bit.
You know, just to expand on that for just a minute, if we are to talk about the biggest issues of the land, we'll talk about Second Amendment and those things. It wouldn't be hard to make the text correct. But on the, how many bills are attempted to be passed in your state annually? I'm sure you know that number. Hundreds, right?
Many hundreds, yes.
How would you, across 50 states, the territories, federal government, across whatever, that 60-something jurisdictions, plus then everything at the county levels, everything that's trying to be passed, you could not account for every individual condition and thing that would come down the pike at you to be a textualist. You would have to interpret things because you can't plan for everything across all of those things all in one shot. You can't.
Well, you actually, if you're a textualist, you don't care about all that. You care about what the text says.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Fine. And so then we'll move along. The New York court specified 7 factors that must be considered at such a hearing: a nature of the crime, the available evidence of guilt, the prior record of the defendant, the punishment already suffered by the defendant, the purpose and effect of further punishment, any prejudice resulting to the defendant by passage of time, and the impact of general public interest of a dismissal of the indictment. As the court wrote, the dismissal of an indictment depended only on principles of justice, not the legal or factual merits of the case, or even on the guilt or innocence of the defendant. Could they not do that in May's case also?
No, a federal habeas court does not have that discretion due to the limitations of the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act passed back in 1996.
Does that mean they used the wrong vehicle to bring this?
No, it does not. They didn't have any other vehicle.
So we got on the right train, but the train is just not possible to take you where you want to go.
Yes, they don't. The habeas court can't do under AEDPA what needs to be done. Unless they're activist judges.
Back to that. On page 12 of the order denying May's motion, it states, although Clayton hearings abound to this day in New York State, there's no federal counterpart. The concept of justice tempering the strictures of the law is anathema to the federal justice system. Accordingly, as Judge Freeland laments, this case, and in particular May's sentence, reflects poorly on our legal system. This is such a tragedy. So had this been written more gooder, May might not be, or like if he had done this in a different state, so just something that's written just differently, he might not be locked up for effectively the rest of his life.
Well, that would depend on the penalty schemes of the state.
Sure.
In most states, they don't have a burden shifting where the Arizona statute was so bad that the accused had to prove his innocence. But I think you're getting deeper than that in terms of the federal habeas is the last resort on state convictions. And that's what AEDPA wanted to limit, because these people, they don't like the fact they're convicted in the state courts. And they protest that, and they go on and on and on with these needless appeals. So when the conservatives were running the Congress in 96, they said, enough is enough. Our federal courts are already overburdened, and they don't need to be looking at state convictions. Our state courts have done a fine job on most of these cases, and we're done with it. So if he had been in another state, and he had to take this course of action by federal habeas, say he was in prison under a similarly burden-shifting statute like maybe exists in Arkansas. They have one similar to us in Arizona. He would have the same result because the same standard applies on federal habeas. This is a federal law. So a habeas judge sitting as a U.S. district judge, when they sit as a federal habeas judge looking at a state conviction, they're constrained by the AEDPA.
What else? Is there anything else that May can do at this point to try and gain some kind of relief?
Not much. He can seek executive clemency from the governor of Arizona.
And, I gotta think that when you go ask the governor saying, hey, I'm convicted on multiple counts of whatever, that the governor's gonna be like, yeah, sure, let's take care of that one for you. I can't imagine that that's a thing that happens with any level of regularity.
It is not.
The court also noted May has now apparently run the gamut of any judicial recourse that might have been available. The only chance he has of not being incarcerated for the rest of his life would seem to be executive commutation. The Arizona Board of Executive Clemency, comprising 5 members appointed by the governor, may recommend the commutation of a sentence to the governor after finding by clear and convincing evidence that the sentence imposed is clearly excessive given the nature of the offense and the record of the offender, and that there is a substantial probability that when released, the offender will conform to the offender's conduct to the requirements of the law. Any chance there?
I think you've got a clip you can play right here.
Oh, yeah, you want me to play that one? So I got to play, is this the... That one?
I fail to see what purpose that would serve.
I was thinking about the Clinton one, but yeah.
Oh, you want me to play that one?
Yeah.
Let's see. Remind me what clear and convincing, what was that, the level of standard, the evidence standard in there?
That's a standard that's slightly below beyond reasonable doubt, but above.
Oh.
Preponderance of the evidence. It's a high standard
to
meet. But what he's got working against him are a number of things. But the statistics, just look at the statistics. I know you're a big statistic guy and you love your statistics. But the Clemency Board, the statistics between 2004 and 2016, it heard an average of 594.9 clemency requests and recommended a yearly average of only 48.2, which is less than 10%, according to my math.
Yes, I agree.
And And in turn, the governor granted only 6.7 per year of those 48 that were recommended, which is just slightly more than 10%.
10% of the 48, right.
So the court went on to say that given the nature of his offense, it is unlikely that the clemency board would recommend that the governor commute May's sentence. And that's on the, see the order at page 24. And folks, you know, I'm the bearer of bad news. I'm not the one who makes the rules. A governor is elected by the people. And unless that governor, I can explain to you why governors are not inclined to do this. Unless that governor has decided that he or she has no desire to hold any other public office ever in their life, they can't take that risk of letting something that's such a sensitive offender, this type of offense is very sensitive. We're talking about multiple children that May's convicted of having offended against. Not one, but multiple. You just can't take that risk because all you have to do is look at Willie Horton, which Dukakis had no idea that they were giving weekend furloughs. And you just can't take the risk. So the governor of Arizona is very unlikely, unless that governor has no ambitions and the governor's office is convinced that this is a miscarriage of justice. But barring the person having no political ambitions, you just can't do it.
Yeah, I'm going to just go with it. This is pretty much a shit show. There's probably a pretty good number of people that are in this particular condition as well.
It isn't. There are indeed a number of people. Through our years of having relations with Stephen, we found out that there were quite a lot in that were dependent upon his success. And there were many that were happy when he won, but all that excitement is gone now because he's now lost.
One other thing. Remind me, just like, just burden shifting, and this is where the burden of proof moves from one party to another?
Yeah, correct. Like in the case of the Arizona statute, similar to the Arkansas statute, if you touch a child, a minor, on certain parts of their body, it's presumed to be sexually motivated. And you, as the accused, under the laws that existed at the time, they have since taken out the affirmative defense, but they had what's called an affirmative defense. You would say, yes, I did touch the child on the butt or on the boobs or wherever, but it was not sexually motivated, and you had to convince the jury that there was no sexual motivation. That spins the burden upside down, because you could touch a minor for any number of reasons that would have no sexual motivation whatsoever. I mean, in this case, he was a lifeguard. You could be pulling them out of the pool. I don't give a damn where I'm touching yet. If I'm trying to save your life, I'll grab whatever I can grab, and I'm not a lifeguard, but I just imagine that I'm grabbing whatever I can get a hold of to get you out of danger. And if it happens to be your crotch, so be it, if that's all I can get my hands on. But you have to, you had to carry that burden under the Arizona laws that existed at that time. The prosecution did not have to show that you had motivation of a sexual nature. They just had to show that you touched. And then the burden shifted to you to show that it was, yes, I did touch, but I didn't do it with a motivation. Well, what was your motivation? And that forced you to have to testify. When you have to declare under oath what your motivation was, then you have surrendered your right to remain silent. Remember, you have the right not to testify. But the only way you can effectively use that affirmative defense is to testify.
I see. All right. Anything more here before we move on to the Seventh Circuit Court?
No, I think we've done this. It's a tragedy. We're sad. We got to know Stephen.
Yeah. I met him at a couple conferences. You took him to one of the attorney conferences. I can't remember what it is.
We did indeed. He went to Vegas and accompanied us on an exhibit. Sure did.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
All right, well then, we've discussed GPS a whole bunch of times, and in Wisconsin's a place that makes you pay your PFR fee even after you've left. Is that right? Is that Wyoming?
That is correct.
Yeah, Wisconsin. Okay.
It's Wisconsin. Yes.
And Wisconsin law requires PFRs to wear GPS tracking for life. Is that all of them or just like tier three people?
No, it's just a recidivist.
Okay. And so they have to wear them for life even after they've completed post-confinement supervision. The tracking device is attached to an ankle bracelet. Boy, like you can hide that one. That would be really awkward to go out on a date with that. And the tracking data is not monitored in real time, but rather officials review it every 24 hours or so to determine if an offender has been near a school, a playground, or other place that might raise concern. The program is administered by the Secretary of Wisconsin Department of Corrections. Thus, he is named as the defendant. I know you people have strong feelings about this. What is the issue that you have with this?
Well, I don't believe it's constitutional to search a person and seize their private location data unless that person has had some due process. It's the same if the authorities went to search a person, the person's vehicle, their home or anything. They need to seek authorization from a court in order to intrude on the person after that person has paid his or her debt to society. So I have great consternation with this because these people that were the plaintiffs in this lawsuit, they were not paying their debt to society. It was already paid.
Wouldn't the due process part be from where they were convicted of the thing?
No. That's as silly as saying that when you have when you've been convicted of a crime, that they would continue to be able to search your house for contraband and evidence of other criminality after you'd paid your debt. You've had the due process, but that due process starts afresh when you've paid your debt in full. You've paid your debt in full. Would you be okay with them coming searching your computer and your cell phone now?
I mean, isn't that like probably the biggest benefit that I have been removed from all the things that I have? Effectively full permissions back other than like gun toting rights. I think that's the only thing that I would need to get back at this point if I cared for it.
Right. But I'm making your argument back to you. Okay with that?
Yeah. No.
So,
obviously the seventh court does not agree with you, Larry. And I've heard you pontificate for years about having the right plaintiffs. Oh, we're plaintiff shopping now. Did they have the right plaintiff in this case?
According to the court, the plaintiffs are repeat PFRs who must comply with lifetime monitoring. And the Wisconsin statute, blah, 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 requires lifetime monitoring of offenders who have been convicted of a sex offense on two or more separate occasions. So they sued the Secretary of Corrections alleging that the statute violates their rights under the Fourth Amendment. I'm not sure if they did have the right plaintiffs. Each of the plaintiffs has been convicted of multiple sexual offenses involving children. That starts giving you some dubiosity. But according to the opinion, Ben Brom assaulted a 14-year-old boy multiple times over a four-month period between 1999 and 2000 and was convicted of two counts of sexual contact or intercourse with a child under age 16. And Alton Antrim has twice been convicted of first-degree sexual assault of a child under the age of 13, once in 1991 for his five-year-old cousin and again in 1999 for molesting another child. And Daniel Olszewski was convicted in 2014 of two counts of possession of CP. Now, the first two really don't sound like all that attractive of plaintiffs, but, you know, I wasn't the one who did the development of this case. But it sounds like that you would not want to use these as posters.
It shouldn't matter, though. No, I don't see that that's true. The plaintiffs served prison terms and completed their post-confinement supervision. It is only because they have been convicted of PFR offenses on two or more separate occasions that they are subject to lifetime GPS monitoring. This can't be constitutional. They also sought an injunction barring enforcement of the requirement. Hey, was that granted?
No, it was not.
Surprise.
So the court noted that it had addressed the issue, the similar issue, once before in a case called Bellew, and that's Belleau versus Wall. And that's for the legal gurus, 811 Federal 3rd at 929. They upheld a subsection of the statute, the same subsection, that imposes lifetime monitoring on PFRs who have been released from post-prison civil commitment. And in applying the Fourth Amendment reasonable standard, they held that the government's interest in deterring recidivism by these dangerous offenders outweighs the offender's diminished expectation of privacy. And that, again, is in Bellew on page 935-936. But I take issue with that because I think your privacy is restored back to its previous level once you've paid your debt to society. But they argued to the contrary, that the registry, the existence of the registry, they used the very thing the state says, well, since they don't have full privacy because they're on the registry, they shouldn't have an expectation of privacy. Now, even you have to admit that that's funny.
It's not funny. No, I'm not admitting any of this shit's funny, because when you talk about privacy and that stuff, I think about people with their monitoring apps to monitor their monthly cycles in the female gender, and that might have their privacy violated. So I'm not really in favor of these privacy conversations. I mean, I'm in favor of them, but the argument is bothering me.
But if the state gets to have it both ways, they get to say that you have a diminished expectation of privacy,
right,
because of the registry, and then the registry itself is in most cases, in my view, unconstitutional, and all the disabilities and restraints that it poses on you. So they get to the benefit of saying that, well, you shouldn't expect privacy. You've got the registry, you're already on it. So therefore you have a diminished expectation of privacy. That is, I mean, funny is not the word, but that is ridiculously absurd.
Yes. I got you. So the court stated, we begin with background Fourth Amendment principle. The Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable searches, and as a general matter, warrantless searches are presumptively unreasonable. This should have ended the inquiry by the court. There is no warrant. This is simply a blanket statute in Wisconsin that mandates the recidivist PFRs be monitored for life. Why did this not end the inquiry and result in victory for the plaintiffs, like right out of the gate?
Well, yeah, not so fast here. The United States Supreme Court, I mean, that's the big court, held in Grady versus North Carolina that warrantless GPS monitoring of some PFRs could be reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, depending on an evaluation of the nature and purpose of the search and the degree of intrusion on reasonable privacy expectations. The narrow question before the court in Grady was whether the satellite-based monitoring of recidivist sexual offenders qualifies as a search. In a brief, very short, per curiam opinion, and that means from the entire court, the court said yes, but went on, it said yes it is, but it went no further. That is, the court did not decide whether this type of search is reasonable, but instead it remanded to the North Carolina courts to make that determination with the following instructions. The Fourth Amendment prohibits any unreasonable searches. The reasonableness of a search depends on the totality of the circumstances, including the nature and purpose of the search and the extent to which the search intrudes upon reasonable privacy expectations. So there's where they got their clause. When I said right above that the person didn't have privacy expectations, well, they took that straight from Grady and they said, well, if you're on the PFR registry, you don't really have the privacy expectations. Well, I maintain that's a civil regulatory scheme, and that's what I've already argued. It has nothing to do with anything here. My punishment is over, and I have the same expectations of constitutional privacy in terms of my person, my effects, and my vehicle, because extension of my home. In my home, I have all these expectations of privacy, and you can't monitor me without an individualized, articulable reason. And the fact that I have a conviction 20, 30, 40 years ago is not enough, but that's what the court said.
Isn't so they that relied some kind on of due process, though? I mean, because the way that this read is that it's some of the people get this. So they get some kind of evaluation to determine which ones get it?
No, they're just being a recidivist. That's all. That's the only thing you've had to determine that. The recidivist, they could have been decades apart, like in the first guys. They were 99, I think, was the last time. So we're talking about more than 20 years ago.
Sure.
Do you stay stagnant and not able to change in 20 years? I don't think the experts would say that.
Leopards don't change their spots, Larry.
Okay.
All right, let's get a bit into the Ballou case, since this decision appears to have been decided based on that precedent. Michael Ballou was convicted of second-degree sexual assault of a child and sentenced to 10 years in prison. He was paroled after 6 years, but his parole was revoked, and he was returned to prison after admitting to having fantasies of two young girls. Just before he finished his prison term, the state sought to have him civilly committed as a SVP under Chapter 980 of the Wisconsin statutes. A court made the necessary findings, and he was committed. When he was discharged from civil confinement 5 years later, he became subject to lifetime GPS monitoring. Ballou challenged the statutory monitoring requirement under the Fourth Amendment, ruling on cross motions for summary judgment. The district court found that the statute unconstitutional and issued declaratory and injunctive relief in his favor. And of course, the state appealed. Correct?
Correct. But before I get to my prepared, I want to just point out that he was civilly committed after he had admitted to having fantasies.
Yeah, that's
about
not recidivating.
Two young girls. Yeah, okay. But now all the people out there who believe that this treatment, when I say it's nothing more than a collaborative fishing
totally
expedition.
Kabuki.
All right. Well, who do you think he made those admissions to?
To the Kabuki doctor.
Okay. But then the Kabuki doctor went and told them to the PO.
Correct.
And then the PO used that against him in this great pristine system we have that supposedly helps rehabilitate people. Mm-hmm. Now, would he have been better off? Now, we can examine this because we've got all the data we need in front of us. Would he have been better off to have kept his damn mouth shut?
Absolutely. I know where you're going. So I had conversations with our good friend that got locked up for the pictures. And he was like really troubled by this of, well, what do I tell the treatment people? I was like, you tell them as little as possible, including lying to them. But he's like, I'm a Christian. I can't lie. I was like, I understand what you're saying, but you have to find that balance of like, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to think things. You may look at something, but you have to tell them what they want to hear. You're like, I don't want to lie. Sorry, dude, you've got to figure that one out. And now he's in prison.
Well, this is clearly to me, I'm taking the court at its word that it has everything before it that it needs. And I don't think it would have printed this as being factual without the parties having stipulated. If the state had said, no, there was more to this revocation than his fantasies, that would have not been put forth as a fact. So as a factual matter, he was violated for expressing a fantasy. And I'm guessing he may have been nutty enough to express it to his PO, but I'm guessing he probably expressed that fantasy in treatment.
Yeah.
So you people out there, you just go ahead and keep telling your treatment provider everything they want to hear and don't learn a damn thing from what we did today. But anyway, I'm going to answer your question.
Please.
Yes, they did appeal and they prevailed. The Seventh Circuit reversed and upheld the statute. They began by explaining that the state has a strong interest in monitoring PFRs like Ballou. His crimes evinced that he was predisposed to commit sexually violent acts, but it starts with a P. Expert testimony had suggested that his particularized risk of reoffending was between 8 and 16%. That generally aligned with empirical studies estimating that as many as 15% of child molesters released from prison molest again. Although they also noted, the court that is, that there's serious underreporting of sexual crimes. They concluded that convicted PFRs like Ballou thus pose a significant danger to the public even after they're released from prison or civil commitment.
All right, well, recognizing the difficulty of distinguishing Ballou from their case, the plaintiffs in this case sought to undermine its foundations. They argued that Packingham versus North Carolina calls Ballou into question. In Packingham, the Supreme Court addressed a North Carolina statute that prohibited PFRs from accessing websites of which minors are members. The Supreme Court held that the statute was impermissibly overbroad in violation of the First Amendment. How did the court respond to the suggestions that Packingham overruled Ballou?
Not very well. And too many people want to read far more into Packingham than they should. The court stated, the plaintiff's reliance on Packingham is misplaced. This case involved an application of the First Amendment's overbreadth doctrine, that's Packingham. This is a Fourth Amendment case. As we've explained, the application of the Fourth Amendment's reasonableness requirement has long involved balancing the government's interest against the individual's reasonable privacy expectations, not the overbreadth analysis. Packingham thus has no relevance here. Now, that's not old Crazy Larry saying that. That's what the court said.
So can they appeal it?
They can. They could ask for reconsideration by the panel. They could ask for hearing on bank, which means the full court. I don't think that either would be granted because the court relied on existing precedent from within the circuit. And as a general rule, a panel on the same circuit does not overturn another panel on the same issue. And they have decided that that Ballou and this case are essentially the same. So I would say the challengers just didn't do a very good job of distinguishing themselves. in this case, and they might have had more hope, but there might be other options.
Is this another one of those cases like we talk about so frequently where no one within our sphere that we know of was informed of this kind of case to try and help them tailor it and structure it and so forth? Like, I don't want to just call you out as being the expert, but you are the expert, and I don't know of many others. Were you talked to about this case?
I was aware of it, but I was not in any way involved with it. But a new case would probably be better. You would initiate a new case with different plaintiffs, asserting that lifetime search is a due process violation because there's no mechanism for relief from the monitoring for the remainder of your life. And I would hate to stipulate that you should be searched after you've paid your debt to society. But within the Seventh Circuit, that's the existing state of the law. So you're not going to get anywhere filing a new action claiming that the search, any search beyond your sentence is unconstitutional. You're going to lose on that. So you've got to come in with a different type of claim with different plaintiffs, in my opinion. And you would say the due process clause of the Constitution mandates that if you're going to continue to intrude, that there's got to be some review mechanism. We've had a number of decisions recently, including South Carolina. That's how the case was won in South Carolina. Or there's another option. They could just simply go through the legislative process and change the statute in Wisconsin.
Right. They could make it so that this is part of the statute, correct? Like the regulatory scheme is that if you have these conditions, that this is what happens to you?
Well, no, they could remove this part of the statute that requires the GPS monitoring. They could, I mean, that would be no problem selling that with the legislators. You wouldn't think that they would. I mean, these good conservative people would like to save money, and having all this expenditures of monitoring and reviewing this data is bound to cost money. So I'm sure they would be very receptive to an argument that you could save some state resources by not burdening the Department of Corrections with monitoring people that have 20, 30, 40, 50 year old convictions.
Can we, like, the technology that they're using seems super antiquated and like shaming on its own, that when you run around with this little box on your ankle, there are other ways of doing this that they do employ. I'm not encouraging them to do this because I would rather see them not have it, but it's super obvious that, you know, you can't really wear shorts when you have an ankle monitor. I mean, you can, you'd be like, hey, look, I got an ankle monitor, but everyone knows. Can't they do it with some sort of cell phone technology instead?
Well, they probably could, but who's going to pay for it?
They're going to make the offender pay for it. I'm sure they're paying for this, Larry. The state's not paying for this. They're charging you whatever, $100 a month or whatever that crap is.
I'm not sure they are in this case. I don't know the details of that, but I'm not sure that they're having to pay for this.
And then, so do they have any other options at this point?
They could ask for, like I say, they could ask the panel to reconsider. That's not going anywhere. They can ask for full court review. That's not going anywhere.
That's en banc, right?
Yep. So they could do that, or they could take a direct appeal to the Supreme Court. And
Do you believe that this is a constitutional violation?
I would not be real hesitant to take this to the Supreme Court like I am on some things, because I think the Supreme Court, based on what they said in Grady,
yeah,
that this is obviously a search. So there's no doubt. We wouldn't have to prove that to the Supreme Court. We would go in with them understanding that this is a search and that the Constitution's Fourth Amendment is in play. And so you would only get into the weeds in terms of the reasonableness of the search. So we would get a question answered. Can you search people after they've paid their debt to society? And does being on the registry diminish your expectations of privacy? So you would frame the case around, does being on the registry give you diminished expectations of liberty? And that would put the Supreme Court of the United States in a very awkward position, because they maintained that it was nothing but a pure civil regulatory scheme, nothing more than just reaffirming existing public information. So if you force them now to say, well, people are suffering the indignity of having a search done on them for in perpetuity for the remainder of their life because of the civil regulatory scheme, what say you now?
Yeah,
I think that this case would have the possibility of getting some traction at the Supreme Court. They might come up with the four justices to grant it cert. The question would be, would the well be poisoned by the type of plaintiffs that they have, sure, you know, type of challengers that they have here? But I think, you know, I'm normally negative, but I think this one would be okay to take to the Supreme Court.
This sounds almost like what the 6-3 majority would be interested in because of the privacy aspect, the unconstitutionality of it. They might not like who the case is about, but it seems like something that the conservative right would be in favor of hearing and ruling in our favor for. Seems like
I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure that they give a damn about privacy, but you've got the question between the conflict between what they said in 03 in Smith versus Doe.
Okay.
And then what they said in Grady in 2017 in North Carolina. And I think that they would almost feel obligated to try to straighten out and clarify what is a reasonable search, because otherwise there's no clarity and you've got the possibility of having dozens and maybe 50 plus different interpretations of what is a reasonable search for a PFR. So I think this one might present an important enough question that they would grant cert, and they might actually get this one right. But I don't think privacy is the last thing that they're concerned about.
There was a Supreme Court case, 2010-ish, with the putting the trackers on cars. And you said a name. That wasn't Grady, was it?
No, Grady was the satellite-based monitoring in North Carolina.
So I recall, forgive me on the details of it, but something about police just taking, you know, a magnetic kind of GPS and sticking it on their car, and now they're surveilling you even with a warrant. And this is like, no, this is overbroad. You're going to search them. You're going to actually tail them and go through that burden of having boots on the ground to go follow somebody around. This sounds exactly the same way as far as you just have a GPS and they're just passively watching where you go instead of like having you report in and so forth. Like, this is totally stepping on their civil liberties, especially what you're saying is after they've paid their debt to society, blah, blah, blah.
Yes. You've got a good petition here in terms of how you can frame up a cert petition, because you can point out their dicta in Packingham, even though it's not completely on point. They said they were concerned about people who had paid their debt to society. So you throw that back at them in the cert petition, that they're concerned about people who paid their debt to society.
Interesting.
And like I say, you've got the 2003 decision where they said it was nothing more to the registry than simply publishing information that's already in existence. But then you say, well, wait a minute. In 2022, we have a state that's intruding with an electronic device that's strapped to my client that monitors their every move, and it tells them where it relates to the state where they have visited, and then they're subject to questioning about where they have been, and they're supposedly free of that because they've paid their debt to society. You've got a decent petition to work here. You just got not very good candidates, but this is some decent material to work with.
I gotcha. All right then. Anything else before we close things down? I got a new speaker to play, and I have your little extra clip if you want to. We haven't played that yet. Do you want to? Let's cover your little extra clip. Set that up.
So, well, we had the mystery speaker last week.
Yes.
And the mystery speaker and the little clip I'm playing this week is one and the same person.
Okay.
Did anybody get the mystery speaker? I'm sure a couple people might have.
I never saw anybody come by with any sort of answers. I've been a little busy, but I'm just saying I didn't see anything come by.
So, well, what I'm attempting to show is I'm not trying to have a debate about the subject matter. I'm trying to have a debate, or at least an acceptance, that people can evolve in their position. And they do that all the time. And I have insults hurled at me because someone has evolved and they're stating a different position. Yeah, I was for it before, I was against it and whatnot. Well, the mystery speaker, we're going to play the same speaker articulating two different positions.
All right. So I'll combine this all together. So last week here, so we'll have a little extended who's that speaker. But last week, this is what I played.
I am pro-choice in every respect and as far as it goes, but I just hate it.
And then this time, this is what you gave me to play. But this is not the who's that speaker. This is just to tack onto it.
You're pro-life, but I want to ask you specifically, do you want the court, including the justices that you will name, to overturn Roe v. Wade, which includes, in fact states, a woman's right to abortion?
Well, if that would happen, because I am pro-life and I will be appointing pro-life judges, I would think that that will go back to the individual states.
Well, all right. So one time he said one thing and another time he said another thing.
That is correct. Now, in fairness, I don't know the year he said the first clip. I do know the year he said the second clip. That was in a debate in 2016.
Yeah.
But when he said the first one, in fairness to him, I do not know when he said that. But just because someone articulates a different view does not mean they're lying. The only time you can say they're lying is if they if their view shifts from audience to audience, not from a period of time and an evolution in how you evaluate an issue. I've evolved in issues. I used to be pro-death penalty. But I'm not lying now when I say I'm anti-death penalty. I have learned stuff I didn't know when I was pro-death penalty in terms of how it was, how the death penalty is imposed and the unfairness. I didn't know all this stuff then. I've matured and I've gotten wiser. And now I don't think that a civilized society should do that. But just don't condemn people because they have two different views. If you're going to do that, just make sure you're fair and you can condemn the people that you support when they do the same thing.
I was going to bring up to you that I just sort of like passively remember that during the initial years of Obama's terms, he was anti-same-sex marriage. And then towards the end, he was. I mean, that could have been lame duck related. He could have just been saying either side of it for political points. Or he ultimately did evolve and change his point of view.
I don't particularly remember his view on that, but we have to put it in the context of 2008 versus when that was the year he was first elected. If he did articulate those views, he was running against the backdrop of being portrayed as a very, very liberal, out-of-touch candidate.
Right.
And he was trying to come across as a moderate, and he governed as a moderate. He turned out to be a very moderate president, in my estimation. Now, there'll be some who'll say that he was the most liberal radical we ever had. And they said that for the whole 8 years he was president, but yep. He was not by any means that. And so he may have been trying to appeal to the middle of the country. I don't know. I just don't remember him taking that position. But if he did, he could have evolved just as the former president evolved in whatever period of time he did, from being pro-choice to being pro-life.
Well, all right. And then to move on, then this is for episode 231. This is the Who's That Speaker for this week. Send me an email and put in WTS231 or Who's That Speaker, something like that, so I can track it down somewhat easily. And some of you are going to definitely recognize this one.
The world is going to end in 12 years if we don't address climate change. And your biggest issue is how are we going to pay for it?
Any idea who that is, Larry?
Oh, I know who that is.
Okay. Since we were talking about the EPA, I figured I would bring that one in because that's a pretty funny statement. I got no confidence. I have zero confidence as my layperson level of understanding of science. The Earth is not going to end in 12 years, and which is probably still like 4 years, 3 years less than when she said that. So anywho, if you know who that is, I'm sure someone's going to say it in chat and mess it all up. So... And is there anything else before we close out, Larry?
Well, I think we might have some new patrons or subscribers to the podcast transcript.
I don't have any new patrons. I looked before we loaded it. Somebody renewed, but I didn't take them as being a new patron. So I don't have anybody to report on that side of things. Did we get any new snail mail subscribers?
I think we got one, but my memory is failing at the moment. But we're getting a lot more inquiries now, so at least people are asking for samples.
And I'll just point this out to you. If you can look up on the screen for just a minute, I have this little section here. It says new transcript subscribers. You could put them there as a reminder. Just saying.
I could if I could just find the time.
I understand. So I think that'll close out the show for the evening. And I appreciate everybody listening. I'm going to try and push this up here. And hopefully like nothing breaks when I do this. I'm going to remind everyone that they need to like and subscribe and do all those things on the YouTube channel, because I often forget to play this little doohickey. See, and it didn't even make the sound this time, which is awesome because all my stuff is broken and messed up. So anywho, Larry, if you want to find all the show notes, it's over at registrymatters.co and voicemail 747-227-4477, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can also find stuff over at fypeducation.org. And if you want to support the program to help us keep on with the work we're doing here, it's patreon.com/registrymatters. And join us for $1 a month and you get the podcast as soon as I release it. And if you want to come in at higher levels, you can send transcripts to your best friends. And at some of the higher levels, you can like actually harass Larry and talk to him on the phone. How about that?
Talk to me on the what?
On the phone. You know, that thing, that antiquated thing that people just text with.
I don't talk on phones anymore.
Oh, okay. All right, then. Well, that's all I got, Larry, and I hope you have a splendid evening out there in the Southwest. Southwest, that's where you are. And I hope you have a great weekend. Happy 4th of July.
Thank you.
Take care, buddy.
You've been listening to FYP.